Welcome again to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, brought to you with the help of our friends at Bauer Group Asia, and we'll tell you more about them in due course. I'm Ray Powell in California, and that's Jim Caruso in Arizona. Jim, how are you today?
My 2.5-year-old granddaughter came to visit and gave me a cold.
That's what they do. That's how they roll.
She's really good at it.
Well, we're joined today by our second ever repeat guest, retired Rear Admiral Mike Studeman, who was formerly Director of Intelligence for the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command and also the Commander of the Office of Naval Intelligence. He is now a well-known national security expert, a public speaker, and the author of the book, Might of the Chain, Forging Leaders of Iron Integrity. Mike, together with retired Army Australian Army General, Major General Mick Ryan, joined us last May for Episode 7, which has since become our most downloaded episode so far. That was Why Should We Care About the Defense of Taiwan? More immediately, Mike recently published a piece on the national security-focused website, The Cipher Brief, titled Straight Talk on China's Offensive in the American Homeland. In it, Mike, you say, like it or not, the CCP has, the Chinese Communist Party, has engineered the equivalent of a silent invasion of the United States, as it has done in so many other countries. For decades, the world's premier Eastern power has been stealthily influencing the world's top Western power on its home turf. Okay, Mike, provocative words. Tell me, why should we care about this?
Yeah, great to see you, Ray, and Jim again. Thanks for hosting the show. I think it's a very important venue for ideas to be discussed and for people to understand what's really going on. And so your ability to pull in subject matter experts and experienced officials and things like that really contributes to the national debate. And so I tip my hat. So thank you. So I don't think this should be actually a revelation, anything that I wrote in my article. In fact, it's a packaging deal, just putting together things that have been available in open press for many years now. But it seems like we have a collective inability to discuss how everything seems to be connected. And so, you know, one of my jobs as an intel officer for 35 years was to do warning for the United States and our allies. And I continue to do it not in uniform now by saying, look, we need to see how everything is connected. I mean, the Chinese are very cunning. They're very clever. They're very smart. And look, they have their own national ambitions, but their predations in the United States continue with such a degree that the balance of power continues to shift in their favor, even as they face economic challenges of their own. And my point is that, you know, if you don't want to talk about Taiwan, or you don't want to talk about something external with regard to influence in the world, the Chinese ability to gain a lot of traction in places that suggest that the world will be a very different place under their influence, then let's look at the home front and let's take a look inside our own perimeter, inside our own borders, and say, you know, what should we be concerned about with regard to malign CCP actions here? And I list 20 different things, and I could have gone on more, to say, look, these things have been handled to a certain degree with various levels of success, but we are not yet as fully serious as a nation as we need to be in addressing them. And until we're actually serious enough, we will continue to have a lot of our IP, our intellectual property, our tech secrets, our trade secrets, et cetera, essentially be hemorrhaged to go to an adversary that tends to reshape the world and minimize the U.S. place in it. So anyway, that's the reason why I talked about now, particularly for a country that may be more isolationist in nature, the things that are maybe inside, maybe more Americans can care about these things and we can raise our defenses.
So it's an interesting take, Mike, and something certainly you've looked at quite a bit. But, you know, Congress is united on one thing, and that's the threat of China. And the administration talks about China as the pacing threat. And when Trump 1.0 was out there, he also identified China as the big issue. And yet what you're saying is we really haven't taken it sufficiently seriously to deal with it head on. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, look, I think that the policymakers have a logic to trying to what they call manage the competition. They don't want to upset the apple cart by demonizing the Chinese and calling out every untoward malign action, which would disrupt a strategic relationship because there's still many areas where we want to be able to cooperate with the Chinese. Not everything about China is malign. There's plenty of benign. The failure, however, is that the White House, the National Security Council, and many others have not really been able to connect the dots for the American people. And my message continues to be the same. Somebody get out there and with your authority, because you're a senior government member representing the president, talk about how all these things are related to attacks on our homeland that actually will carry deep consequences. Now, the Congress and the CCP Special Committee totally get it. And they've been trying their best to pass legislation, and they have. But they have like 150 more ideas that they know need to be implemented for us to get truly safer than where we currently are. And those have been sort of caught up and stymied in some of the current politics in the lame duck session. So CCP Special Committee gets high marks. They clearly see the challenge. And you can read, if you want to go to one place to read exactly what's happening, take a look at everything they put on the website, go through it, and see what else they recommend still needs to be done by way of protecting America against the CCP. And you will see, in fact, we've got a lot of work to do. But there isn't the similar kind of voice that, unfortunately, needs to come from the White House that says, yes, these things are valid and we need to pursue these as an all of society approach. And that's been the missing element so far, unfortunately.
So in your article, you refer to this person, this spokesperson, as a, quote, China sage. What made you choose that as sort of the title or the term of art?
Yeah, you know, I submitted the paper around to a number of different people, and somebody that I trusted said you should probably use the word sage in this regard, because it's sort of a corollary to have perhaps those kind of advisors in, you know, Imperial China. They had sages that would be there. And my point on this is to say, okay, you need somebody that actually knows what they're talking about, not a public affairs official that's reading off talking points. They're really brilliant people. They're very quick on the uptake. They're not subject matter experts. They shouldn't be the front facers for subjects where you want to have a conversation and actually answer the journalist's third question, right? And getting into a level of specificity that can really provide traction for action. And so you need people that really know and have the depth on the particular problem set. And you need to have somebody that's actually endorsed by the president to be able to do so. Now, typically, this would be maybe on the National Security Council staff, the senior director for the Indo-Pacific, or maybe the director for China and Taiwan or something along those lines. But they've been busy doing implementation of policy and, you know, developing policy. And so so clearly maybe too busy to be able to be available to the press. And I think we need to regularize somebody that has that role of simply informing America about how to think about these new developments, because almost every week you find a different kind of report about Chinese behavior, and people don't know how to think about it unless you have somebody that says, this is minor, this is major, this is how this is connected over here to the Chinese grand strategy, and here's what we need to do to protect ourselves, and here's actually what we're doing. Let me pass you on to the Defense Department or Homeland Security or the FBI, you know, for more details. But we don't have such a centerpiece for understanding China and America today, and we're suffering because of it.
So try the sage, try the czar would be responsible, in your view, for a public outreach. Do you think they would also be responsible for helping devise not just defensive measures against these predations, but offensive measures to discourage further activity by the CCP?
I think we have people that should be doing that on the National Security Council in concert with Congress and departments and agencies. I think that we need, what we've been missing is somebody that actually can talk and be trusted by the American people to be able to explain what's really going on. You can't expect a politician, as someone who becomes a president that has a different background, to be an expert, right? You can't sort of just say, I want to go all the way to the top. But you can need to go near to the top, and they need to have the president's backing to be able to be honest to the American people about what's really happening. And look, you can't share everything. There's some things that truly are classified and they need to be protected. But there's a lot that actually can be shared. And that's just not being done today. So I think an additional player on the president's staff, not a public affairs official, but somebody who's a true SME, should be considered as the new administration comes in.
So you talk about a lot of different ways in which the Chinese Communist Party has been conducting this silent invasion, quote, as you call it, in the United States. And of course, there's nothing that maybe has got as many headlines recently as this issue of hacking. We've had this thing called Salt Typhoon involving telecoms. We've got this now this hack of the Treasury recently. How big is this problem? And for your average American, what does it mean for them that China has been hacking all of these different entities?
Look, this has been going on for years. I mean, it's weird that every time it happens, that people are in a tizzy for, you know, a week or 2 weeks. They think it's dramatic and then they move on without substantial enough activity. Look, the government is very busy. Homeland Security, CISA, et cetera, FBI, they've been educating private companies, particularly those in critical infrastructure. They've helped them with capabilities and tools to inspect their network, give them tactics, techniques to be able to defend themselves. But fundamentally, the architecture in too many places is still too old and still more easily penetrated. And the Chinese are very adept at actually using sometimes the weakest link, which is the human link, not the technical link, to be able to get inside. And it shouldn't be a shock. Salt Typhoon, Volt Typhoon, all those things should not be a shock. It should be, once again, a clarion call to the American people that we need to actually do something more substantial than we're already doing, right? And some of these things are going to be really hard for the United States. Do we need to have regulations where we expect more investment in the technology for the more critical aspects of our critical infrastructure? What does that look like? How do we be fair with private companies on implementing, you know, more of the advanced capabilities that will defend against advanced persistent threats? Until we have a national conversation about the depth of this problem and the width of it, the breadth of it, most people aren't going to be willing to make these tough choices because they don't have the context that allows them to go, oh yeah, this is really big and really important. I need to do this because the rest of the country is going to be way more vulnerable if I don't. And so far, we just haven't put the right kind of pressures in enough places to be serious enough to get the public-private cooperation going to be able to truly make ourselves more defendable and hardened in a way that's suitable to the threat. So it's not that we're not doing anything about it. There's plenty of great initiatives, but the capacity of those initiatives relative to threat is too low. And government can't do it alone. And so it's going to need to actually work with people who are not in government to be able to do these things that we're talking about. And it expands from research labs to academia, all the way through to our tech companies and beyond. And so really, this is whole of society.
That's a hard thing. We are a large, diverse, sometimes undisciplined society. So getting this all around will be tough. And for every 10-foot wall, there's an 11-foot ladder. So I worry that, can we ever do enough? Is it perhaps we need to do more on the offensive side to discourage this Chinese activity?
Yeah, I think we need to have options. But at the same time, I think the larger issue is ensuring that there can be a rising tide of defenses that lifts all boats in the United States. And a lot of Americans still are not convinced, or they may subtly or generally understand the problem, but they are not willing to take sufficient action or put enough, you know, effort behind something. Think of a Wall Street investor who still invests in Chinese companies because they want to turn a buck and make a killing. not understanding that they're actually generating capability that could end up killing American service members. So how do you talk to those guys about how they're, you know, seeding our own destruction, right? Or fueling things that will end up hurting the United States or killing American service members. They don't like those conversations. That if they think you're alarmist, they don't know how to understand the depth of that issue, because we're not having a national debate about the seriousness of how you could get into a situation like that. So they continue to do what they do. Now, there's been obviously there's more risky options for dealing with China. People have backed out because of the economic reasons, but it's not because of the patriotic reasons so much, I think. Unfortunately, it's just the pure business smarts there. It's just a riskier environment in dealing with China. But look, on those, so those are things that if the president and his team were much more pointed, not hyperbolic, not sensationalizing the problem, not painting China as, you know, completely malign, but discussing where benign and malign leave off, so that people understand that, you know, certain states that deal with the Chinese on food supply and trading soybeans, et cetera, totally benign, right? High tech issues over here, perhaps it's not going to be benign. That's actually going to feed the People's Liberation Army and a killing machine that intends to actually reshape East Asia and then the rest of the world. So I think that there are ways that the senior officials in our government need to talk about this problem that make people understand without having them go high into the right and go burn down their nearest Chinese restaurant. That's just not the solution. I'm associated with a counterintelligence commercial company called DTEX. There are also other commercial counterintelligence companies that are out there that look at insider threat, et cetera. And they have an ability to do monitoring for risk no matter who you are with inside your company, and look for behaviors that suggest that something untoward is happening. More companies need to be wired so, and to take this sort of stuff seriously if we're going to nip things in the bud. But unfortunately, it's just not the approach that we're taking in enough places.
Well, so that leads us to the question of, you know, when we're talking about Americans being co-opted, you recently got a lot of attention for something you said about Elon Musk, who, of course, may be America's most important industrialist, who is now, of course, also very politically powerful. And you described him as, quote, compromised and co-opted by the Chinese and a Chinese sympathizer of high order. All right, Mike Studeman, why did you say that?
Well, look, I mean, I think he pursues his business with a fulsomeness that's very impressive. At the same time, when you're in bed with the CCP, you're going to be influenced, if you're beholden to the CCP, on a number of different issues. And so Elon Musk, unfortunately, has decided to repeat Chinese CCP propaganda about Taiwan as a renegade province, et cetera, that needs to be folded back into the motherland. And so that's a demonstrable piece of evidence in the fact that Elon is an extension of the CCP's voice, and he has a pretty big one with X now. And so that's a conflict of interest. There is a very strict business sense where you can say, well, you do anything to curry favor with the people that gave you free land and an ability to do business in China. But at the same time, you know, this is a conflict. And the question that we should all be asking is whether or not these conflicts of interest carry over into his advisory role, you know, when he goes into Doge and decides to make recommendations to the president about how to alter the U.S. government. And so this is an unknown, but I would tell you that anybody that is concerned about CCP influence would take a look and go, the guy that's been influenced by the CCP up to this point, coming into this position, may continue to be influenced in a way that may not be in the best interest of the United States. So we have to be on alert for this. And that's the reason why I think people are asking for FBI reviews of some of the senior officials coming in to say, what is the level of risk that we're onboarding with some of these people that are being put into positions of great influence? Look, you know, it's an issue. If Starlink, for example, has a null zone around Taiwan because Elon Musk wants to make the CCP happy, then that's a problem if we're trying to support Taiwan and allow it to, you know, defend itself against increased aggression from the PRC that aims to assimilate Taiwan. And so where people stand really matters these days. And so I do think that this is a concern and it should be something that we are very wise to as we go forward.
You know, Mike, this gets into U.S. government over many administrations relying too much on a single source, whether it's Starlink for communications of this sort, or critical minerals that are processed in China, permanent magnets, which are vital for our defense, coming from China. So it's not only that we are vulnerable to hacking and intellectual property theft, we are vulnerable to China on an industrial basis. Is there something in the intel side that we didn't alert our government to, that this was happening? How could we have gotten ourselves in this situation without intel folks highlighting it?
Well, I think intel has been providing plenty of warnings over time. But inside the government, look, you had policymakers for up until the first Trump administration that were still on the hopeful engagement strategy that we were going to transform China by engaging with it. And therefore, it was not seen as a the kind of threat that it's become. And so, look, you got to be fair to where people, you know, rationally were trying to take a look at China with a more hopeful sense of where, what it could be. Those people, of course, didn't understand that everything with China was not transformational. It was transactional for them. And that we've had that awakening. But now we are in a pickle, right? So there's a great deal of effort that's been gone into trying to reduce our dependency on supply chains, which are fundamentally fragile or potentially victimized by the Chinese. But it took us years to get into this. It'll take us years to back out and to look for alternative sources. And for many years, we will still be dependent on critical Chinese supplies. And the Chinese know that. And so this idea of the tariffs and the trade wars that may ensue in the new administration, but the Chinese are going to attack back. They're going to use the Trump tactic, right? If you are attacked, attack back harder so that you start to shape an influence of behavior. And China has already demonstrated by showing its hand with regard to limiting certain supplies for things that allow drones to operate, critical minerals, et cetera, that, you know, this there's more to come from the storehouse of Chinese options to be able to deal with an American attack on this front. So this thing will be a multi-iteration test of wills here where economic warfare will play out. And frankly, we'll see who has more stomach for it. But I suspect Xi Jinping now knows what to expect, has already developed options to be able to retaliate, as Evan Medeiros has pointed out in one of his recent articles, and is ready for what's to come. And the question is whether or not America is actually going to continue to support their president through all these iterations, because the penalties and the costs, the ramifications to the American economy, the American businesses, may be a lot more damaging than people estimate at this point.
In terms of that, you talk about in your article how China wants to exploit American divisions, political, cultural. How does China do that? How do they actually carry out the sort of exploiting the breach as far as American political divisions? And what can we do about it?
Yeah, I would say that we have to worry about China and Russia in different ways, but the same objectives are laid out for their cyber forces and their patriotic hackers, their mercenary hackers that they have. But there's plenty of influence work that private companies are aware of, the U.S. government is aware of, where the Chinese are attempting to use their media reach through cutouts, through personas, or, you know, with legends to be able to cop like there are different entity that's operating in the blog space, blogosphere, or somewhere on social media to be able to essentially amplify our divisions. And so they're going to use bots. They'll be using deep fakes. They'll be using a number of different AI tools to be able to increase the scale and the impact and the authenticity of some of those things that they know Americans will react to, because we as a nation don't have enough digital social education to be able to search for verification before we react. We're a very emotional country and we're very polarized, and the Chinese and the Russians and others know this. And so they continue to touch these nerves, and they can do so through, you know, today's technology. And you expect more of that going into the future here. So, you know, the harder thing is to say, okay, show me the effects of all this activity. And that's really hard to measure. But we do know that we're a pretty divided country that has overreacted to many of things that both the Russians and the Chinese have been behind. So they'll continue, because there's no accountability to the Chinese on this, they'll continue to do so. They'll try to hide it, but they'll continue to do so going forward, because it's just a winning approach.
You mentioned about 20 different areas of vulnerability to Chinese influence here. Is there a priority list for you? Is there something that has to be done immediately and other things can sort of be legged into?
I think the cyber, the intellectual property theft, $250 to $600 billion a year is the area where we need to spend a lot more time. And look, we're trying, right? We've done a lot of different things. This debate over how much regulation should exist and what areas, you know, is key. But I just don't think that we can afford to have hundreds of billions of dollars of our IP stolen. And the fact of the matter is, it's not all keyboards in mainland China. A lot of these go back to the human element and the Chinese Americans that are in certain companies that are willfully giving this stuff up. Some of that may be transferred through digital measures, but there's a counterintelligence issue and a cyber vulnerability issue, which is intertwined. You cannot de-link them. And those two things need to be approached with a lot of seriousness. You're never going to get 100% foolproof protection, but you need to raise the cost of doing business, and you need to actually be able to have, you know, more companies be aware of the threat and do more and have an ability to do more at cost to be able to protect against this. And some of this is like vetting your people. Some of it is monitoring insiders. It could be, you know, a white American, you know, with a idea that they want to make their own business and they steal the IP. That's as significant a problem as an ethnic Chinese supporting the motherland. So look, there are lots of reasons why private companies should have good commercial monitoring of their insider threats there against any comer. But the fact of the matter is, we're just not taking it as seriously as we need to. I'm particularly offended by the labs, whether you're a lab associated with an academic institution or you're a government lab. They have been, unfortunately, repeatedly either naive or victimized, and they haven't got their act together. Strider put out a report about 160 researchers that were at Los Alamos National Laboratories that operated there and went back to China to help support their hypersonic program, their deep earth penetration weaponry programs, their unmanned programs. 160 researchers from China in a U.S. national lab. And it's that kind of stuff that we can't afford to be naive about. And yet we are, because we're not having the national conversation. The pressures aren't being put in the right places and people aren't taking it as seriously as they need to be, still protect their rights and their and the values that are things that we cherish in this country. But there are risks that we just have to do something about and not to sit there and take it like we have been.
So in terms of ethnic Chinese Americans, it would seem to me that they would be also under threat. I mean, we've been reading about these police stations that have been set up by the Chinese Communist Party in other countries, including in the United States. Recently, one was sort of discovered in New York. how do we protect our own citizens, our Chinese American citizens, from that kind of coercion?
Yeah, I think that we've smoked out those in the United States. I wouldn't put it past the Chinese to continue to do some things that are quieter. There are plenty of Ministry of Public Security and Ministry of State Security folks at work in the United States to be able to track down, monitor, coerce, and in some cases render, as in try to get back to China, some of these dissidents. This is happening in too many places, too often. The Chinese have an effort. They hold up these Chinese agents as heroes when they're able to do this overseas in a variety of different countries. And so the Chinese will continue to support all efforts to be able to essentially shut down dissidents and their voices. But this is actively occurring in our country. People come at with false pretenses and then end up trying to find out where these dissidents are and threatening or actually physically trying to take them back, coercing them. So this is just something happening on American soil. Should you care? Do you want to do something about it? Do you think that a foreign country has rights to have agents like this behaving this way within American society? So yeah, it's an issue. I think the Chinese now are aware that they can't set up a police station here. That's going to not attract attention and quickly be dealt with. But that's not the case in other countries. It's been very, very successful to have all these extra police stations all over. And it shows you the Chinese global influence and the confidence that they have to be as brash as they are, to putting these things right in common view.
So you're at very senior levels of the intelligence community in Washington, and now there's a debate whether we should continue to have a director of national intelligence or not. Do you believe that function is important and useful, or should we go back to the way things were before 9/11?
No, I think that the director of national intelligence needs to be the director of national intelligence and to do things that sometimes individual agencies haven't been able to do. I would say, for example, that, you know, in many ways, one of my personal criticisms is that oftentimes the director of national intelligence has behaved as a coordinator of national intelligence and hasn't been unwilling to direct the agencies, as in CIA and NSA in particular, as the two big pillars of the community, to do things that, frankly, those bureaucracies have a very hard time doing themselves. A good example is on selective disclosures of Chinese malign activity in the United States and in other areas. We've done better at selective disclosure, but you still have essentially CIA and NSA sort of minding the store, and they will always judge whether or not to release something based on the risk of jeopardizing sources and methods and not the risk of inaction. In other words, the risk of not sharing this carries some consequences. That's not weighed by NSA and CIA as much. That's where the ODNI staff, the Office of Director of National Intelligence staff, and the National Intelligence Managers and the Director of National Intelligence need to be able to help direct NSA and CIA to do more with selective disclosures, which they bureaucratically, fundamentally are resistant to do because their loyalty lies with their institution. That's an example of an area where I think the DNI needs to be more the D than a coordinator, right? And so in that respect, I do think that they need to get back to what the original charter was. They can be cooperative. They can help enable and empower all of the other agencies to do what they need to do. But for certain issues, they actually need to take charge and carry out the imperatives that we need to pursue as a country. And in that respect, that's where I think some reform needs to take place, is to truly be all that a director should be on the critical issues of the nation. By and large, I would say the ODNI staff is filled with many people from the CIA. They have been able to take up those positions. So there's some undue influence, perhaps, that the Central Intelligence Agency has over the ODNI. But by and large, really good people there, trying their best. I think that we need to take a look back at the National Intelligence Managers, of which I was one at the time. I was the National Intelligence Manager for Maritime. They were supposed to direct all the analysis and collection for their particular area. That was a charge that they had, but very few of those NIMs were actually able to have the power to be able to direct other agencies to actually modify collection and analysis in a way that was truly influential. They could do it on the margins, but when push came to shove, usually an agency would be able to overweight a national intelligence manager. And that's where, the DNI's empowerment of their own staff to be able to coordinate on collection analysis needs to be done with discipline and empowerment to be able to do the right thing as initially identified by, you know, the committee and the statutes that created the DNI in the first place.
Well, we want to thank you, Mike, for your time and for informing this extremely important conversation. I note that a topic that we didn't necessarily delve into, but you did bring up in your discussion, was that, you know, you said that we are that this is idiosyncratically different from the Cold War, but the nature is the same. And you've used words like invasion and offensives in the American homeland. So it's obviously a very uncomfortable topic, but it is a very important topic. And we want to thank you for talking to us about it. On the way out, where can we learn more about Mike Studeman, what he's doing now, and tell us a little bit about your book and how it's doing?
Yeah, thanks, Ray. So the book is doing pretty well. Sold about 1,500 copies. The audio book should be out hopefully in the next couple of weeks, so people can, you know, have another option there besides the ebook and the paperback book. And so I hope that people, particularly younger professionals, pick this up and they get a earlier start in figuring out exactly what it takes to be the best possible leader that they can be. Because given these challenges here, and it's only one country we've talked about, not, you know, Russia and Iran and North Korea, et cetera. But I think our world is going to be even more fraught with risk and danger. And so becoming a really capable leader throughout all this is something that is going to be important for the next generations. And so I really aim for younger people to perhaps get some pearls of wisdom through might of the chain, forging leaders of iron integrity. I intend to maybe look at writing some more here as I think about my post career. You can track me. I'm on X. I'm on LinkedIn. I actually started up on Facebook just before Christmas too. So, and then if you want to go to my book website, it's www.mikestudeman.com, and you can kind of see some other things there. And you can join a newsletter. I send it out every 2 weeks, and it's free stuff that I simply talk about a leadership issue. You can read it in less than 60 seconds. So, you know, Ray, Jim, Ian, who does the support in the background, thanks for everything you do with this show. I'm a strong supporter of the ideas that you're bringing out, and more importantly, some of the solutions that we need to consider as we move forward as a country.
Mike Studeman, might of the chain. Thank you very much, sir. And our sponsor, as always now, is Bauer Group Asia, a strategic advisory firm that specializes in the Indo-Pacific. Bauer Group Asia applies unmatched expertise and experience to help clients navigate the world's most complex and dynamic markets. In fact, my co-host, Jim Caruso, is a senior advisor with Bauer Group Asia, who you can find at bauergroupasia.com. Well, Jim, a little bit of a confession to our audience, our YouTube audience already may have noticed that something is amiss, since even though we tried to be very careful to wear the same clothes as when we first tried to do this a few days ago, I am now sporting shorter hair. So no, I did not very quickly get a haircut in between the guest and this segment. We actually had to re-record this. So Jim, once more, act like we just did this. Mike Studeman is a fascinating guy because he is looking at, as he likes to say, he's connecting dots. He's seeing a bunch of things come together and he's saying, look, I am seeing a particular picture here. I'm seeing something like a silent invasion of our homeland. Now, you and I have experience with another person who has used the exact same language, in fact, wrote a book called Silent Invasion, but this was an Australian author, who a guy named Clive Hamilton, who in 2018, while we were in Australia, wrote a book called Silent Invasion about China's influence in Australia. So there's a theme here.
There is. And Clive was a professor in Australia. He was also a climate activist before he became a China activist.
Yeah.
So it's not like he's some right-wing troll.
To make it great, if you read the preface to his book, you might recall he was out in 2008, the kind of the inspiration for this book. He went out in 2008 during the running of the Olympic torch through Canberra to join the Free Tibet crowd, which, people of a certain age know, Free Tibet is an old-time left-wing cause. You used to see the Ford Pintos and such drive around with a Free Tibet bumper stickers on them. He comes from that. He was a Green Party guy, I believe, in Australia. So he was not being the warmonger looking for trouble.
No, but what he saw was in the Chinese community, all the Chinese language media was being taken over by entities in the mainland. Voices were being silenced on the university campuses that they spoke out against the CCP. He was concerned about, as we know, the telecom industry, the 5G, having Chinese entities controlling it or installing equipment. So, he was very much on it. And Australia, to its credit, passed new anti-interference laws as a result.
Right. I made reference to it. The preface to that book about the Olympic torch was quite striking because essentially what happened is he shows up to sort of join the Free Tibet protesters and finds himself kind of engulfed and swarmed by very aggressive pro-Beijing protesters in very large numbers, sort of waving red flags and screaming. And, he's, where did all these people come from? And, what gives them the right and the gall to come out in the middle of Canberra and protest in front of the parliament building or not protest, but actually counter protest or, sort of shout down this little Free Tibet group that he was in. So, it's a very good book and very striking. Mike is now bringing this back up, but I want to go back, Jim, to his description of Elon Musk. And again, he calls Musk compromised and co-opted, a Chinese sympathizer of high order. And as you and I have just seen, because since we recorded the episode, we're now just today, it's the day after the inauguration. And the inauguration was, of course, dominated by Donald Trump. But Elon Musk was a large, large presence throughout that entire event. And, you have to look at that and say, what does this mean in terms of this idea of an invasion, a silent invasion?
I'm reminded when I was a Foreign Service officer, every year I had to give a listing in great detail of every stock I owned so that they could determine if I had any conflict of interest in anything I did. Pretty much no matter how little of the stock I owned.
Right.
Now we have this individual who owns a huge investment in China.
Yes.
Now it's declared.
Yeah.
But clearly there's concern in general in government about conflict of interest.
Right. Yes. No, I mean, so people understand, this is getting very favorable terms on being able to set up manufacturing plant in China, a massive market that is in China, actually, I believe, has received loans from Chinese state banks. I mean, there is a lot there that, you know, all it means, it doesn't mean that he's necessarily a bad guy, right? In fact, I introduced the topic with Mike, and I said, look, I mean, he may be the most important industrialist of our time, right? I mean, what he's done in space, what he's done with Tesla, well, these are hugely important ventures, you know, just sort of nationally. I'm not anti-Musk. I'm not anti-Elon. But this is hugely concerning because it's exactly what you said. There's a massive conflict of interest.
Well, and we could also go to the TikTok decision that President Trump signed an executive order on that basically overrode Congress and the Supreme Court finding that Congress's actions banning TikTok, which, as we've heard from other guests, is a very dangerous tool in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. And by extending the deadline to disinvest, or suggesting, well, maybe if half of it's owned by a U.S. entity, that will make it okay, I don't understand what that solves. And frankly, what's the conflict of interest of a Chinese company supporting Donald Trump and then Donald Trump apparently doing them a solid by not acting on Congress's law?
Yeah. Now, I don't know. I mean, the whole thing is very complicated, but what's not complicated is the law that Congress passed, right? And so we get back to, it was passed by Congress. It was contested, actually, you know, before by the Trump, the incoming Trump administration, before the inauguration. It was decided 9-0 that the law was, that there was nothing wrong with the law. And so, you know, we're now, what I, there's still this option that the, if there is an imminent divestiture, that they can have 90 days to sort that out. There does not seem to be an imminent divestiture. So, of course, what happens over the next 75 days, which is what the executive order grants, it is going to be fascinating to watch. Also, just bizarrely, and again, I guess I can explain this as just a coincidence, but they had the TikTok CEO, Shaoji Chu, sitting right next to the Director of National Intelligence nominee Tulsi Gabbard at the inauguration. I couldn't help but wonder, are they trolling us? Is this just, what is this? And maybe it's nothing. Maybe it was a huge coincidence, but it's just bizarre.
But, you know, it goes to what Mike was saying. The danger is serious. The danger affects all society. It requires an all-society response of awareness and counteraction. But these actions seem to downplay the threat.
Right.
So it depends. Who's right?
Right. If it's a silent invasion, then these actions are completely dissonant with that. This makes no sense whatsoever. And so it's, how do you interpret those things? And that's where what Mike is saying is important, because we have to ask the question, is, you know, I hate to put it this way, but I mean, are we already at war? Now, that's going to sound very, you know, controversial, but China doesn't do war in only the way that we think. You know, they do something essentially called political warfare. It is an important warfare for them. Gray zone warfare. It is sort of exploiting these places before the actual shooting starts to try to get what you want short of armed conflict. And if we don't sort of come to terms, like, you know, the Philippines is very, very familiar with this. Taiwan is very familiar with this. They endure it every day. And again, what Mike is saying is we need to wake up, because actually there is warfare going on all around us. Look at these hacks. These massive hacks of government, of telecoms, of Americans' privacy going on right now, and are we sleeping through it?
Well, certainly so far, it looks like the snooze alarm has been hit.
Well, we will have to come back to that. Jim, you have to cheer me up. I'm a little depressed. I need to hear a story. Tell me a story.
Well, since you have a haircut, I will give you a second episode of The Adventures of a Hairy Man in Asia.
Okay.
So we're still in Thailand. I've been going to the same barber down the street for a while. And I go in there, and there she is. And I say, in my very, very limited Thai, the usual. And she looks at me sort of quizzically, says, the usual? I said, yeah, I don't know why she was concerned, but anyway. So she takes her electric razor and starts here and goes, zit.
Oh,
and there I am.
Unusual.
Oh, I thought to myself, what happened? It turns out my barber has a twin, an identical twin, who sometimes cuts hair for her. And this barbershop, it turns out, is where a lot of Westerners go when they're going to enter a monastery for a while. And so they get their head shaved. So I was just the usual white guy coming in for a shave.
So did you join the monastery?
I should have, because my wife really didn't want me around the house.
I'm happy to say that when I go and say the usual, they are able to look me up in a computer and know what the usual is. So I may have an advantage over Jim in 1923 or whenever it was that you were in Thailand.
Oh, Ray, with that haircut, you shouldn't make comments like that.
That's true. That's true. I do live in a glass house, or at least glass-sided ears here. So, all right. Well, Jim, I want to thank you for your second edition of A Less Hairy Man in Asia, apparently after that story. And I want to also thank our producer, Ian Ellis Jones, who is once again making waves with all of his military and geopolitical graphics, one of which he did for me for a article that I just published on the Dispatch on the South China Sea. So thank you for that, Ian. Follow him at Ian Ellis Jones on X. If you enjoyed this episode, you'll want to watch more of them. In fact, if you go over to YouTube at IP Podcast, you can see episode 4, where we talked to Lieutenant General Lori Reynolds in Why Should We Care About Beijing's Cyber Aggression? And she made the case for why we need to be concerned about TikTok. You can also see us on, of course, if you like to listen to us, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, etc. You can see us on X at Indopac Podcast, or on LinkedIn, just search for our name. And of course, now you can email us, and we're getting more and more listener emails. Some people are suggesting guests, which we appreciate. Many very good guests. A couple we've already had, which just means that they have the same, our listeners are having the same ideas we have, but many are also ones that we're starting to keep a list and think, okay, when can we get these guests in? Finally, you might want to just follow us follow our sponsor, Bauer Group Asia, at bauergroupasia.com, and they are on all the socials. So, for Jim and Ian, I'm Ray with a new haircut. Jim does not have a new haircut, but he will go and get the usual. Thank you for joining us on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?